sweeten my spirit, calm my head. Let me be rational when crazy things are said. My arms are extended in friendship deep and warm. Make me peace in the eye of the storm. When my friends are in conflict, when my family is in pain, whenever there is much to lose, let my action bring the gain. I was born into this time to show the world I care. Let this be my mantra, let this be my prayer. Make me peace in the eye of the storm. Sweeten my spirit, calm my head. Let me be rational when crazy things are said. My arms are extended in friendship deep and warm. Make me peace in the eye of the storm. People need to know that anger is a choice. In the eye of the storm, sweeten my spirit, calm my head. Let me be rational when crazy things are said. My arms are extended in friendship deep and warm.
Thank you.
Good evening and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Community Church of Hendricks County. I'm Sam Carman. I'll be the moderator this evening. And the song that was chosen for tonight was Make Me Peace, and it was written by Skylark. We're a progressive congregation consisting of people of many beliefs, some with a religious background, some without, some who believe in a God, some who don't. Our beliefs are diverse but inclusive. We have no shared creed, but instead we share a covenant, including our seven principles, which you can find posted on the wall back there. Whatever your faith, whomever you love, we welcome you with all your truths and all your doubts, your worries, and your hopes. We're a community that embraces freedom of thought, where people come together to encourage each other to spiritual growth that makes for peace, ethical living, and community service. During these Chautauqua sessions, a collection plate will not be passed, but donations are graciously accepted. Donation plates are located, one in the back table there, one in the overflow room in our fellowship hall. And you're also encouraged to join us afterwards tonight downstairs for refreshments. If you have any questions about our church, feel free to explore any of the literature that you'll find on the tables, and you can also speak with any of us that have a name tag on. And now I'd like to introduce this evening's speaker. One of the factors that help maintain a civil society is the rule of law. But what if the people that those laws were meant to govern and protect, at some point, they come to a point where they no longer trust their government's rule of law? Former U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius said, the essence of good government is trust. Soviet Union founder Vladimir Lenin said, trust is good, but control is better. Well, tonight we will explore this topic, and to guide that exploration, we are honored to have former Indiana Supreme Court Justice Myra Selby. Myra has served as both the first African-American and first female Associate Justice to the Indiana Supreme Court. She was born in Bay City, Michigan, received a Bachelor of Arts degree with honors from Kalamazoo College, and then went on to get her degree in law from the University of Michigan. We won't hold that against you. She practiced law in Washington, D.C. for 3 years before beginning her practice in the state of Indiana as an associate attorney with the law firm Ice Miller. In 1993, she became Indiana's health care policy director before her appointment to the state Supreme Court. While serving on Indiana's Supreme Court, she authored more than 100 majority opinions. In 1999, Myra retired from the bench and returned to private practice at Ice Miller. In addition to practicing law, she has been an adjunct professor at IU's School of Law, and she chairs the Commission on Race and Gender Fairness. Please welcome Myra Selby.
Good evening. Okay, we'll try that again. You sound kind of sleepy. I know it's raining out. Kind of sleepy day. I drove through the rain and out of it 4 times getting here from Indy. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, all right. So, the rule of law. When I told my family that I was giving a talk this evening, and first of all, my son, 22-year-old son, said, "What is Chautauqua? What is that?" So I got the opportunity to do the thing that makes a parent of a millennial joyful. I was able to say, "Go Google it." Which he did, and it was one of the few things that I was delighted to say engaged him in a conversation with his mom that was not at all about social media, social anything. And in fact, when I was talking to him about what I was going to call the talk and what sort of the title and the byline and all of that, he debated a little bit. He got a little feisty. And then when I described why this area of thought is meaningful to me, and I also described it in biographical fashion, which Phil asked me to do in a short, brief biography, I said that I'm most concerned about a degradation in the belief or an erosion in the strength of the rule of law as it relates to people that I see of his generation, particularly, and I describe myself as the mother of millennials, the mother and aunt of African American and biracial millennials. His criticism was this: "Mom, no, don't say that." I said, "Well, why not? That, you know, I'm speaking about you and your sister and your cousins." "Well, I know who you're talking about. I know who we are. Just call us what we are." And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, "Don't call us that made-up name, millennials." I said, "Oh, of all things to be offended." I said, "Okay, well then what shall I say? What would be a better word?" And this is amazing to me because this is a young man. I always have to stop and remind myself, you know. Yes, he's a young man. He's not a kid or a guy or a boy anymore. Who is not, you know, we don't often think of, you know, as a deep thinker. He is, but it's sometimes hard to really see that, to access it. So he said, "Call us what we are." And I said, "Okay, and what would that be?" And he said, "Young people. It's the same now as it was when you were my age." And I honestly was speechless for just a moment. And so I realized that, you know, I, like many of us in my generation or of generations more senior to the millennials, we make assumptions all the time. My children are 11 years apart. My daughter, being, you know, more than a decade older than her brother, despises any description that puts her with him. Because in her view, he's a child, he's a kid, he's ridiculous. So I started this journey, putting these remarks together, being warned about assumptions. And I heed that warning, I take it seriously. But with that, I'd like to share some thoughts with you on the rule of law. So what is it, first of all, the rule of law? Let's just be informal. How many people have heard of those words, the rule of law? Yeah, so very familiar. And I dare say that while we've heard it and we sort of think we know what it means, do we really? Well, the American Bar Association's World Justice Project has established a working definition that's comprised of four principles. One, a system of self-government in which all persons, including the government, are accountable under the law. Two, a system based on fair, publicized, broadly understood, and stable laws. Three, a fair and robust and accessible legal process in which rights and responsibilities based in law are evenly enforced. And four, diverse, competent, and independent lawyers and judges. The World Justice Project acknowledges that the rule of law is a term that is frequently used but rarely defined. The World Justice Project, also known as Raleigh, bases its definition on the belief that the rule of law is a prerequisite for building societies that offer opportunity and equity to all of their citizens. Further, the World Justice Project outlines a set of components that give meaning to the rule of law concept. The first component of the rule of law is due process. The concept that establishes that every person is entitled to what? A fair and impartial hearing to determine their legal rights. A second component to the rule of law is the separation of powers. This separation of powers in government ensures that no person is able to gain absolute power and stand above the law. The governmental framework need not be a U.S.-style government. However, the chosen framework should allow for each governmental branch to serve as a check for the other branches. Another important component of the rule of law is societal respect for the law. The Justice Project highlights that citizens agree to obey the law in order to maintain social order, thereby creating a social contract between citizens and the government. Additionally, judicial independence is a necessary component of the rule of law. This concept ensures that judges are independent from political pressures and influences when they make their decisions. Further, judicial independence establishes notions of fairness, ensuring that everyone has a fair chance to make their case in court and that judges will be impartial in making their decisions. Other elements of judicial decision making, such as mandatory explanations of decisions in judicial opinions and appellate decisions, are also components to ensure that judges are independent and accountable to the rule of law. Another component is the right to counsel. The right to counsel supports the notions of fairness and impartiality in the rule of law and help define that defendants have an equal standing before the law. The distinction between law and justice is another very important component of the rule of law. Even if the law is uniformly applied, a just result is not guaranteed. Let me say that again. Even if the law is uniformly applied, a just result is not guaranteed. A society operating under the rule of law must remain vigilant to ensure that the rule of law also serves the interests of justice. The World Justice Project quotes Martin Luther King using that quote to show that advances in the civil rights movement display the continued strength of the rule of law. I would pause here and lift up some other names that remind us that laws, even if uniformly and universally enforced, don't always guarantee a just result. Our American experience of the civil rights era, and the person who's one of my heroes, Thurgood Marshall, long-serving justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, and die-hard civil rights lawyer, understood that in order to bring a fair result and a just result to the many criminal defendants prior to his landmark case, the case he's known best for, is the school desegregation case, Brown versus Board of Education. But in reality, Justice Thurgood Marshall really spent the bulk of his lawyering career in the civil rights arena. And in every case, he would put together a defense for the defendants that he was working for, understanding that he had to work within the rule of law. No matter what injustice he felt or his clients felt had been done or worked upon them, he was going to bring about a different result. He was going to change the result and seeking justice even where the rule of law was fully operational. A final component of the rule of law is the need for openness and transparency in lawmaking and the need for those laws to be applied predictably and uniformly. Openness and transparency allows for citizens to better understand the law and its reasoning before they are asked to obey those laws. Further, the predictability of the law ensures that laws are not arbitrary and citizens can use the law to guide their behavior with reasonable expectations of legal consequences. Josh Dansby writes that he has identified two key elements of the rule of law: predictability and security. Dansby adopts the definitions of the thin theory of the rule of law, which states that government officials and citizens are bound by and abide by the law. Additional requisites and themes include that a particular decision made under rule of law is not necessarily a rule. The law must be generally known and understood before it can have the force and effect of a rule in terms of guiding behavior. Further, the thin theory of the rule of law encompasses the themes, including the notion that government is limited by law, the notion of formal legality, and the idea embodied by the expression, the rule of law and not of men. The United States has numerous structural safeguards in place to ensure that government is limited by law. So we think of these things when we think of how our government is organized, including the notion of the separation of power, which upholds the rule of law by establishing independent branches of government with distinct duties and obligations. It is imperative that the judiciary be independent so it can appropriately interpret the law, solve disputes, and hold other components of the sovereign accountable to the laws. Further, the notion of formal legality is based upon providing consistency and predictability throughout the legal system. Finally, the idea embodied by the expression, the rule of law and not of man, seeks to shield the rule of law from human excesses and weaknesses, such as prejudice. In the United States, the independent judiciary furthers this ideal by acting as the mouthpiece of the law, unbiased, educated in the nuances of law, and ideally transforming from subjective man into objective judges. I'd like to pause there for a moment and share with you an experience that I had and that several others had when our as Sam indicated in his introduction, I have the privilege to chair the Supreme Court's Commission on Race and Gender Fairness. And in a word, the mission of the commission is to examine the legal and judicial systems in our state to ensure that they are and remain fair on the basis of race and gender. So our work is statewide. We have a commission of about 21 or 22 members, judges, lawyers, citizens, and as I said, we work across the state. Well, when we began our work, I think it was maybe 9 or 10 years ago, we conducted forums all around the state in about 6 different geographic areas within the state. And these were open public forums where people would come in on a evening, Tuesday evening or a Wednesday evening, and talk to us about their experience, particularly with the courts, the court system, the police, and any other aspects of the legal system that they had encountered. And we heard these remarks and we talked to them, and it was a conversation that happened in the 6 locations that we went to. We were north, south, central Indiana, east, and west. One of the things that we discovered that frankly surprised many of us and many of the judges and lawyers was that there were people coming to the forums, and as it turns out, many of the people that were expressing these views were people that were either from families who had immigrated here, or they themselves were immigrants, living in Indiana and had lived in Indiana, many of them with extensions to their local school systems and so on and so forth. But many people were not aware and did not understand that, something that many of us take for granted. When I talk about separation of powers, that's the sort of the overriding, overarching concept, right, of legislative, executive, judiciary, right? Well, first of all, we got people in these forums that had no idea what that meant, But more importantly, and for our purposes more disturbingly, they believed, they were convinced that the police tells the prosecutor what to do, and that the prosecutor then works for the judge. All right, let me say that again. The police work and tell the prosecutor what to do, and that the prosecutor works for the judge. So, when we took in this information, and obviously it wasn't everyone at these forums, but it was a substantial component in several of the cities that we were in, we realized, and we took it back to the, you know, the IU center, Polis Center, I think it's called, for research. Tell us what this means. What do we do with this? I mean, we're over here concerned about fairness issues, and we've identified a basic lack of understanding of how the system works. What do we do? And we were told things that just sort of put a full stop to our work for a moment. And one of the things that we were told was, this is a common misunderstanding of the system, of the justice system, and it is not held just by immigrants. This is a common misunderstanding because although a subject called, I think it's called U.S. government, is taught in schools, high school, the broader concept, which we were told was used to be described as civics, I think it was civics when I was in high school actually, is not taught. And so, particularly for students who are from families that are not from here, but not limited to that, we arrive at this very kind of loose and in some cases erroneous understanding of our justice system. And so the other judges on the commission and indeed the Supreme Court, who we report to, were really shocked and concerned. And so, of course, we're still working with educators to support broadly civic education, broadly. And there are really great programs out there. Some are, just to name a few, We the People, and other programs that are specifically designed for high school and middle school students to learn about how government works. But that was an aha moment for our commission, that we needed to do more than just look at systems the way they exist. We needed to actually go back to those communities and help them have a clearer understanding of our system. So we did another round of public forums about 3 years ago, in which that's exactly what we did. We did some of the basic sort of educational focus. This is how the system is put together. This is how it's meant to work. And we're still doing some of that work, but it really was that moment for us where we took that step back to understand that you can't build upon something without a foundation, and we were assuming a certain level for the foundation, and we were not correct. So again, we have a lot of safeguards to ensure that our government is limited by laws, and again, the separation of powers is sort of the bedrock of that. I think that also it's important to sort of think of the rule of law as the sort of collective acceptance that it's a necessary and proper aspect of our society. Necessary in that if in fact we do have this social compact, there will be trust in the law, that this trust, but the trust must be earned from generation again and again to generation by legal actors living up to their obligations. This belief is the result of years of history, culture, and tradition within our society. When the United States engages in rule of law operations for other countries, operations are successful when those countries acknowledge the importance of ongoing efforts to bolster civil society, in addition to structural changes. Other societies' negative view towards the law may be common, where the law has a history of enforcing colonial and authoritative rule, or when legal officials are perceived to be corrupt or inept, or when content or application of the law is seen to be unfair or identified with particular interest groups within the society or with the elite. And we can name any number of countries. The American Bar Association World Justice Project, which I am quoting extensively from, takes their work into countries that invite them in. And they invite the ABA Raleigh Project in because they want a rule of law based system in their countries. And so this world justice effort works all across the globe, not to take our government or our way of government to these other countries, but rather to work with them to achieve what they want in their country. But for the most part, the very first thing that they want is a rule of law system of some sort. Although many of these countries do lack the essential element of the rule of law, societal trust in the law, adopting societal changes towards the idea of rule of law is something that many of them do undertake, and it takes generations to accomplish. So, where did rule of law come from in the first place? Most of us raised our hand, right, at the beginning and said we've heard of it before or we know what it means. Well, it seems that the phrase was first captured by an English scholar by the name of Albert Van Dicey, and he was one of the first individuals to use and popularize the phrase rule of law. Over time, the underlying concepts were developed through inherited traditions and with roots in the philosophy of law and government. And today, there are many different modern definitions that I've shared with you just a few. Many of those definitions and concepts have their roots, though, in Albert Van Dicey's definition. So what are the threats to American rule of law? Well, one of the most valued commodities of rule of law is, as I mentioned earlier, stability. Since the judiciary holds many of the primary responsibilities for maintaining the rule of law, it follows that one of the largest threats to American rule of law comes from the judiciary. Specifically, Dansby highlights judicial activism as a threat to the rule of law. This danger is present when the role of the independent judiciary shifts to a judiciary in which judges substitute their own biases and opinions for the law. Further, Dansby stresses the importance of selecting judges that can judge independently to uphold the rule of law. Judgeships, particularly in the Supreme Court, can be and have been treated as a political game by senators and the executive, with less attention given to integrity and skill than how they, meaning those in the political sphere, may feel a judge would vote on an issue. Moreover, it is incredibly difficult to address any issues involving judicial activism once a judge has been sworn in. Difficult to address issues of judicial activism because of the system for removal of judges is intended to protect their ability to be independent. Additionally, Dansby identifies judicial abdication as another large threat that the judiciary can pose to the rule of law. Separation of powers establishes duties for each branch of government, and it is the duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. The judiciary ought not to abdicate its role by avoiding legal questions that are tough or uncomfortable to decide and leave them to another branch of government. Additionally, Dansby addresses that judges may label a legal issue a political question under the discretion of the political branches of government in order to avoid answering difficult legal questions. Abdicating the role and duties of the judiciary negates the purpose of the separation of powers and therefore puts the rule of law at risk. As you can imagine, this Dansby guy doesn't like judges, believes that judges really are that stronghold for the rule of law to be and remain strong. And he believes that judges are not sometimes doing their jobs within a rule of law system. Now, I would say that what Dansby refers to as judicial activism, which is something that you hear about in popular press and media, is those are two different things. I think Dansby is truly talking about when judges don't pay any attention to the law. And I think what we hear and is often the subject of debate, particularly when someone has issued a controversial decision or when the cameras are on during confirmation hearings and so there's lots of attention, those tend to be, I think, overwhelmingly politically charged moments, but not necessarily assignable to the judiciary as a body, as one of the three branches of government. So too, Dansby's concern about abdication. Because again, sometimes a judge will express that a particular concept or rule or change is not for the judiciary to do, but rather for the legislative branch of government. And indeed, sometimes that expression by a judge is exactly that. It is defining something not to be within the judicial sphere and more properly within the realm of the legislative branch. In many cases, those things come down to a particular judge's philosophical approach to judging. Well, what about changes in the American veneration to the rule of law? There have been significant threats to the rule of law in the last couple of decades. Threats that have arisen by virtue of national security and social order. Specifically, the rule of law was threatened shortly after the 9/11 attacks, when national security demands were heightened. In the aftermath of 9/11, many people, including President George W. Bush, argued that strict adherence to the rule of law may threaten national security. This argument suggests that rule of law could be perceived as an unnecessary barrier to national security goals, and specifically the war on terrorism. It follows that national security demands may become so extreme that the public may believe it is no longer necessary or practical to follow the strict enforcement of the rule of law. Following 9/11, the deviation from the strict application of the rule of law was in some part legitimized. Thus, it is clear that national security and social order can pose serious threats to the American rule of law if the citizens ultimately lose faith in its importance. Despite this particular threat and others, the data collected displays that the American citizens largely still support the rule of law and have not significantly wavered, either in the aftermath of 9/11 or even throughout many, many public safety and other controversies, school shootings, police action against young African-American men on our streets. These things, although they do support questioning the rule of law and how the three branches of government are in fact operating and whether justice is being meted out under our rule of law system. When polled, Americans have remained committed to the notion of rule of law at much higher percentages than citizens of many other countries. In the particular polling, and that included Hungary, South Africa, France, and Spain. However, there are threats to the rule of law that are still valid, and regular efforts to monitor cultural commitments to the rule of law are necessary. To sum up, not surprisingly, I believe that the rule of law is the only way that we can continue to be strong and support a civil society. I believe that the rule of law is a necessary thread to the tapestry of civility in America. Thank you.
All right, at this point, we will open things up for questions, discussion. We have two microphones, right? So we'll circulate around the room. If you have a comment or a question, please raise your hand. And be brief. We do want to allow time for anyone who wants to comment to do so. I will mention, too, if you use this microphone, you need to keep it pointed directly at your mouth because it doesn't pick up well if you do that.
During your study and your work, did you discover why people had that misconception between the prosecutor and the judges and law enforcement?
Well, we were informed that some of the folks who had come here from other countries that had different, most likely had different forms of government, simply didn't understand that the U.S. was different. And some really, although they did learn it, they did know it, they didn't believe it, they didn't trust it. And so either one are problematic in terms of an explanation, but the one that it seemed like we could influence to change was what people were learning in school.
I thought you might mention Citizens United as a threat to rule of law, if I've got that right, where freedom of speech is a basic right we have, and the outcome of proper use of freedom of speech is legislation that protects all. However, and this is not from the legislative branch or the executive branch, but the judicial branch itself, that ruled that corporations have freedom of speech, and therefore they can contribute funds towards legislation that they approve of. So do you have some comments about that? And maybe I'm way off, or maybe?
Well, I don't know that you're way off. I don't know about that. And Citizens United is that's a Supreme Court decision, U.S. Supreme Court decision, that the holding was pretty much as you've described it, that corporations have essentially the same right of free speech as individuals. And I would say that to me, the beauty of the rule of law, belief in the rule of law, is that it envisions and supports and stands up under wrong decisions. And I think, so one might say Citizens United is a wrong decision, or one might simply disagree with it, but I don't think that a single decision, even as wide-reaching as that one, will undo our rule of law system. One of the reasons I say that is because, and I'm not advancing my agreement or disagreement with that case because I haven't studied it recently, but one of the reasons I say that it won't undermine the rule of law is because within our judicial system, if you think about it, decisions that you disagree with set up the opportunity for you to change them. And so the moment that decision handed down, there were people who were extremely upset, extremely disappointed, and have been working to change that result. Now, what happens? That was a judicial decision. So this branch of government over here, the legislative branch is where they're trying to now work to change, as well as within the judicial branch. So again, it's I'm not an architect, and I don't know one thing about architecture, but it seems to me that the three-branch construction lends itself to supporting the whole system, and no one decision can undo it. So.
Hi. I was wondering if your commission looked at all at issues of class, because it seems to me that when our laws work as written and we operate under the rule of law, inherently poorer people are discriminated against. And I'm thinking about pretrial detention and bail. So when the law is operating as it should, poor people are going to end up in jail awaiting trial, and wealthier people are able to make bail. And we know that this affects the outcome of their cases. So is your commission, as it looks at gender and race, did it ever look at class? And then I know there are some states that are talking about getting rid of bail for that reason. And is there anything like that percolating in Indiana?
It is percolating in Indiana. We are not charged with class as a component or a social or other determinant of treatment in the justice system. But we did in our work, because we do work in the criminal justice space, we did report back to the court the effect of pretrial detention, and it's different county by county in Indiana. So So there is no statewide system of pretrial detention. It's there are many, many aspects of it that are very county driven. And I'm happy to say that our current Supreme Court, of course, led by Chief Justice Loretta Rush, is looking at pretrial detention and the effects that it has on defendants as they move through the system, and the disparity that is just inherent in that system, not necessarily due to the components that we look at, race and gender, but simply not just the economics, but also the access to systems to support, you know, bail. So I know, for example, that in Indianapolis, the Bail Project, which is a national undertaking that is offered to certain defendants the opportunity to have their bail paid through a central fund. The Bail Project is operational in Indianapolis. Now, it's on a very small level right now, and it's not really enabled by a statewide rule authorizing this. But I think that's the direction that things are moving in.
There's been a lot of talk in recent years about the politicization of the U.S. Supreme Court, and it seems now that in significant cases we can almost predict how the justices will vote. Do you see that as an indication that the court has been politicized too much, when we can predict who will vote and how they will vote? Do you see that as a sign of stability, or as a sign that the court has become too predictably politicized, and that justices have been picked more for their philosophy than for their commitment to the rule of law?
That's a very, very tough question. Thank you, Phil. Someone smarter than I will have to answer it. I will say just a couple things. I frankly don't think that decisions are quite as predictable as you might. And maybe it's because I've been on the inside of a process like that. And so year after year, when, you know, the judge's summary of the court's year would come out and they would say, Selby most often votes with this one, or Selby most often dissents against that one, I would read that and I would think, who are they writing about? Who are they talking about? And they were talking about me. But it never felt accurate. Some things, yes, on the numbers, if you see decision after decision where the voting block right now, it seems to be the voting block of five, or the voting block of six, 2-1, or the voting block of 7-2, consistently happen, you have to think that there is, in some respect, a thought process. But in reality, I guess because I really believe that each judge, each justice on the court has his or her own judicial philosophy and set of personal beliefs and strengths, as well as weaknesses. I really don't think that it's a sort of a predictable mantra. I think we see in Chief Justice Roberts that people predicted, people never would have predicted that he would write the opinion that he did in the Obamacare case, upholding the Accountable Care Act. No one would have predicted that. So I think the minute you start along that prediction pathway, it's not going to be very long before you're going to be surprised or wrong. So I just don't. I understand what you're saying, and I see that the numbers seem to carry you there, but I think that's for reasons different than all marching to a consistent drumbeat. I think there are vigorous, active, heavy debates going on in the conference room of the U.S. Supreme Court. I think those debates now are being carried by and large by those justices that have the more conservative views. But please understand that does not mean that the judges that don't hold those views, or maybe on a particular case disagree with that point of view, are not there making those arguments, because they are. And they're all brilliant people who believe in every case that it is their point of view and opinion that should carry the day. So that's also why I believe that our system is strong and the best in the world, because that happens no matter what, and no matter whose name is on the seat, from what political party support came from, what state the person's from. They're all there doing their work really largely for the same reason.
excuse me, yes. With respect to your comment about the Supreme Court working to deal with the bail issue, Hendricks County is one of the pilot counties under the auspices of the Indiana Supreme Court, and we've made great progress in screening people who are arrested and getting them released rather than holding them in jail for a long period of time before they come to trial. So I'm very pleased at what the Supreme Court is doing, and happy that we're able to participate. Also, you had mentioned the idea of civility in court. In my years of practice, I've been in courts in many counties in the state, and I have observed in years past that it seems that some judges take as their as the judge to imitate Judge Judy with the snide comments and so forth, which does not, of course, bode well, I think, for the impression that's given to those who appear before those judges.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would agree with you there, and I, you know, one of the things that I think that we deserve as a country is always the highest degree of professionalism and integrity in the judicial branch. I'm not going to speak to the other two branches, never been in them, don't want to be, but certainly in the judicial branch, that's what we should have, I think in all instances, at all levels, because after all, when citizens come into our courts, almost always, no matter what type of case it is, whether it's a divorce and you're ending a relationship and oftentimes affecting children and property and futures, or it's a business dispute, or it's a criminal matter, that day for that person is the most important day in their life. And so everyone deserves for the person or persons who are taking their life in that case in their hands, even if just for one aspect of their life, they deserve to be treated with professionalism and integrity. And those are things that the system doesn't necessarily structurally always deliver. Those are human components. And so we do need to make sure that that's always present.
How seriously do you think public trust in the rule of law is threatened by the confluence of several things that at least I would observe right now, such as that educational deficiency that you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. Things like disproportionate incarceration of people of color, mm-hmm. Members of the judiciary and the president himself refusing to even comply with essentially every subpoena that comes his way, just a whole variety of things that would seem to me to be tearing down trust in the rule of law.
Well, I am concerned that the multiplicity effect of all of these things happening do threaten rule of law. I think what we see happening with respect to the ability to flout the law without consequences, that goes to the heart of rule of law. That's why rule of law works. So if we begin to see that this happens, or even if we begin to feel like, you know, remember what I said, it's a system of laws, not men. Well, where are we on that specter? I think that, although I think that a lot of people get very concerned about the president's conduct as it relates to legal process, I think we're still at the point where much of it is talk, and it's his talk. And it's usually not his lawyer's talk, it's usually his talk in the age of Twitter and, you know, unrestrained comments. So I think that's another sort of, you know, control that's still effective. But frankly, I think that we, and that's why I went back to, you know, sort of bouncing my introductory remarks off of my kids and my nieces and nephews who are of that generation, because they don't think the system's working too well. When I had to sit as a mother one night and explain to my son that a young man lost his life because he was lost or wandering in his own neighborhood wearing a hoodie, you know, you don't feel like things are likely to go well necessarily in a society where we have had examples again and again and again of, you know, law enforcement not regarding life. And obviously also lots of circumstances and lots of indications where, you know, training and experience and all of those things were factors. But all of that should be in our system. We should demand it as citizens. We should demand that police officers be properly trained and properly armed and supported. Because when they're not, we see what happens. So I do think these things are concerns.
I'm very, very grateful for your talk today. Thank you very much. What worries me most about the conflict between the three branches of government, particularly judicial and executive at this point, is that if the current executive is successful, when it all comes to the end, 2 years, 3 years, whatever it takes, if he's successful and the Attorney General is successful, I think there's going to be a terribly large portion of the population very disheartened. So I'm afraid, I think I can't see that happening, but that's always a fear.
Well, I think you hit it on the head. When you say him, I assume you're talking about the president, but then you added, because the him part doesn't bother me. The part that you added that does bother me is the Attorney General, because that is now in play in a way that it has not been previously. And so if the Attorney General decides and takes action to uphold and defend the executive branch and the president's flouting of legal process, then I think we're on a pathway that is extremely troubling, extremely troubling. Now, I don't know that that's going to happen. That seems to be the, you know, sort of the noise that's being made. But again, at the end of the day, I think we have to sort of listen carefully and try to hear through the noise to hear really what's going on. But it's definitely a concern.
Thank you for coming.
Sure.
Speaking. A couple decades ago, a law was created that allowed low-income kids to get their college education if they stayed out of trouble, graduated from an Indiana high school, and went on to an Indiana college. But even though that law was created, what I discovered 15 years ago was that the counselors in the school were not steering those kids towards the college-bound classes, and even telling one child that he's not going to college because he doesn't need college. So the program was judged to not be very successful because the children were not taking advantage of it. And in reality, the counselors in the school system were undermined. Yeah, the law was there, but there was nothing in the law that forced the system, the rest, the educational system, to do the best for the children.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that will fix that part? You know, it's like I know your branch, it's like they can't bring a lawsuit against the school system for not doing the best for the children. So it's almost like a void exists between the people who make the law and whether or not it gets carried out.
Well, I guess I would question whether or not, I would question why not bring a lawsuit against the school system for not doing the best for the children. I mean, I think that would be the very moment and the very reason why someone would make that challenge. And of course, depending on how the law was written, the law may not require the school system to do anything other than access this funding or access the pathway. So again, I think sometimes we lack creativity, and I certainly put myself in that. I'm not a creative person at all, but our country has been shaped and formed by some of the most creative lawyering, really, that you can imagine. Many times, not on a sort of a linear pathway, but you know, going around and through and up and down. And so I think one of the things that we just must be vigilant about is that we have this system. It's a great system. It it doesn't mean, again, it doesn't guarantee just results. And so, but you can use the system and work the system and work within the system to challenge and to bring about justice. So I don't think that just saying we have a rule of law system, everything is great. No, I think that means that we have a system, and if we are vigilant about making sure the system works as it is intended, it will be and give us the flourishing civil society that we really want. We aren't there at this current moment. Some of it is because of just what my pastor used to call foolishness. Just foolishness. Name-calling, belittling, behavior that we teach our children at the age of 4 and 5 you should not do to another person. We know that that's wrong. We don't have to study a system. We don't have to understand a system. All we need to do is remember what our whatever caring adult was in our life who said, no, you should not hit Tommy for no reason. No, you should not spit in Margaret's face. You should not call Billy a mean name. How would you feel if that's how you were treated? All of that is going on at the highest levels of leadership in our country right now. I think we all know what to do about it. I think each and every one of us knows. And we should want to do something about it. If we maintain the system that we have, we can. But casting about as if, oh, there's just nothing we can do. Oh my gosh, what's this guy talking about? What's he doing? You know, I would have gone to bed in 2016 and never gotten out of bed.
We have time for one more comment.
Isn't it beautiful? Isn't it beautiful? That's America.
But I mean, what you're going to end up with is people being arrested and tried in Indiana who has no law about it, or a very strong law
right.
about it, versus, you know, Illinois will probably fairly soon have complete recreational use. I mean, when
does... When are we going to get past? I mean, it almost looks to me like those conflicts are going to be a lot of money for a lot of lawyers. But other than
that, you know, I think there is a pathway there. I mean, just in humor, I'd like to say, yeah, that's the greatest thing about America. That every state can be its own, you know, upside down, inside out self. But you're right that in an area like this where the state-by-state approach to regulating behavior and criminalizing behavior is not workable, is not going to be workable. And so I do think that there's going to have to be a federal solution because I think, you know, and right now it's unlawful federally everywhere. Well, we know that that's not sustainable because pretty soon there are going to be more states that legalize and then that don't. You know, we're on that pathway now. Indiana will be, I predict, 33rd. Mark my word on that. Mark my word on that. 33rd. We will not be in the top half. We will not be in the bottom half. We will be 33rd. So I think that's going to have to come federally. And honestly, one of the reasons that we don't see that moving right now in Congress is because Congress is spending its time on what? what? Foolishness. Reverend Landrum Shields, foolishness.
All right, let's thank
him. We done?
Thank Myra again.
Thank you very much, and hopefully she can join us downstairs.